Oh, Tim, I've just got it again. You have 5 recording minutes left. Add 1 hour for $5.
Click yes or whatever if they want. Give it to
trying
them.
To do that. Sorry, Courtney.
No, this is a hoot.
Let's see. It's not really doing any. Oh, successfully purchased. Okay. We're good. We can keep going for another hour.
I owe you a beer.
Welcome to part two of our 2 hour conversation.
Parking beer.
Yeah. I think you should include that. That's so funny.
Hello. On today's episode of Shelf Life, I talk with the author, Courtney Maugham, on how horses saved her from depression, finding inspiration in the life of Peggy Guggenheim and her daughter, and two contemporary novels that are nothing if not original. One involves a student specializing in poisonous botanicals. The other is about a disfigured young man operating a popular choose-your-own-adventure game from the seclusion of his home. Join us after this.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Protesters faced off with federal agents in Chicago after reports of a shooting incident involving federal personnel. The tense standoff drew big crowds. Chicago Alderman Byron Sigjo Lopez was there and later spoke to the Wall Street Journal.
It was a shooting earlier, an ICE involved shooting. We want to demand an investigation. There are escalating violence. There are escalating violence in the city. This is not making anyone safer.
Authorities are urging calm as investigations begin and anger grows over the escalating confrontation in the heart of the city. A federal judge has temporarily blocked the Trump administration from deploying the National Guard to Portland, Oregon. The order issued yesterday said the government has not shown that recent protests outside an ICE facility were a rebellion that justified sending in the National Guard over the objections of state and local officials. The deployment is halted while the matter is being litigated. The Supreme Court opens a new term tomorrow. It promises to be enormously consequential and focused in large part on how much power the Constitution gives to the president. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
While the justices have allowed Trump to fire independent agency directors and to carry out race-based detention policies, those rulings were temporary, and many are now returning to the court for full evaluation. Then, too, there's the case challenging Trump's massive tariffs. A federal appeals court ruled that Trump exceeded his statutory authority by relying on a 1970s statute that doesn't use the word tariff and has never been used to justify a tariff. In addition, coming soon is likely to be the unanswered question from last term. Did Trump exceed his authority when he issued an executive order limiting a constitutional provision that guarantees full citizenship for every person born in the United States? Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
At least 5 people were killed and more than a dozen injured after Russia launched a large-scale drone and missile attack on Ukraine overnight. Most of those killed were in Ukraine's far west, which borders the NATO country of Poland. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports from Kyiv.
The Russian attacks also caused a fire at an industrial park in the western region of Lviv, as well as power cuts in some districts. The mayor of the city of Lviv said there were no military targets in the area. Russia's airstrikes also hit the southeastern Ukrainian city of Zaporizhia, according to the regional governor. Apartment buildings and an industrial enterprise were hit. At least 1 person was killed and at least 10 injured. The attacks come a day after Russian drone strikes killed a French photojournalist in eastern Ukraine. A Ukrainian photographer was badly injured in the same strike. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
This is NPR News in Washington. Heavy rain brought floods and landslides to Nepal. Entire villages were swept away. Officials say at least 44 people have died since the rain began Friday. Since major highways are closed, helicopters are assisting with medical evacuations. The government has issued a severe rainfall warning in the eastern and central parts of the country through tomorrow. Nepal's monsoon season usually ends in mid-September. Puerto Rican singer and rapper Bad Bunny is continuing a high-profile week, kicking off last night's season premiere of Saturday Night Live as host. NPR's Matt Bloom reports his monologue focused on his upcoming Super Bowl performance.
Bad Bunny poked fun at the blowback among some Trump administration officials and conservative media outlets over his Spanish-language music catalog.
I'm very happy, and I think everyone is happy about it. even Fox News.
The halftime show is expected to be performed entirely in Spanish. After speaking a few lines, Bad Bunny joked that if people didn't understand him, they had 4 months to learn. But he also expressed pride. The 31-year-old has been an outspoken critic of Trump's immigration agenda. He's skipping the U.S. mainland in his upcoming world tour, citing concerns about ICE raids and safety for his fans. Matt Bloom, NPR News.
In women's basketball, Game 2 of the WNBA Finals will be held tonight. The Las Vegas Aces lead the best-of-seven series after beating the Phoenix Mercury. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
Oh, Tim, I've just got it again. You have 5 recording minutes left. Add 1 hour for $5.
Click yes or whatever they want.
Trying to do that.
No,
sorry,
this
Courtney.
Is a hoot.
Let's see. It's not really doing any. Oh, successfully purchased. Okay. We're good. We can keep going for another hour.
I owe you a beer.
Welcome to part 2 of our 2-hour conversation.
I think you should include that. That's so funny.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. Hello. My guest on this episode of Shelf Life is Courtney Maugham, the author of 3 novels, including I Am Having So Much Fun Here Without You, Touch, and Costa Alegre, one of Glamour magazine's top books of the decade, which was inspired by the real-life figure of Peggy Guggenheim and her daughter. Maugham, who has just published a memoir, The Year of the Horses, in which she writes about turning to a childhood passion for horses as a response to depression, is also the author of a best-selling guide for budding writers on navigating the travails of publishing. She has said that when she started writing her first book in 2003, I wasn't professional about my writing. I didn't research. I didn't outline. I didn't stress. I was very romantic and naive about the process. I would wait until a mood hit me, and then I'd just start writing. But you can't pay your mortgage by being verbally romantic. So now I write like a goddamn professional. Professionalism is one hallmark of the novels that Maugham has chosen to talk about today, both of which feature 2 of the most distinctive voices I've yet to come across. The first, published in 2020, is Hex, by Rebecca Dinnerstein Knight, about an expelled biology PhD candidate obsessed with botanical toxins. The second is Wolf in White Van, a novel by the musician John Darnielle. Courtney, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Aaron, and thank you for that lovely introduction.
You're so welcome. I mentioned your new memoir, The Year of the Horses. In that memoir, we join you at a moment when everything, at least on the surface, appears to be going right. You've had a child, published your first novel, which has been very successful. You've just moved from Brooklyn to a fixer-upper in the bucolic Berkshire Mountains of Massachusetts. When was it that you realized that something was wrong or off for you?
Well, that's a good question. My body realized it before I did. I've struggled with chronic insomnia for most of my life, unfortunately, from a really early age, around age 7. And my body just started to break down. I quite literally stopped sleeping. Even with sleeping medication, I couldn't sleep. Whereas normally my insomnia manifests for maybe 2 to 4 days, you know, during stressful or very exciting periods. And this time it just went on for months. And I started dropping a lot of weight, which was really noticeable because I'm not a very heavy person for starters. And then I started having irritable bowel syndrome and my body was just breaking down. And before thinking of more traditional forms of therapy, such as talk therapy, I was living in the Berkshires. It's quite a new age space. So I went first to the acupuncturist, then the nutritionist. And they told me, you're just steps away from a complete adrenal failure. But I was under contracts for my second book, and the deadline was staring me down the barrel. And I'm just very hard on myself, and I'm a real perfectionist. So I just remained in denial and tried to make everything work, and keep all the plates spinning. Mm. But ultimately, I missed my book deadline. And, I'm a big Virgo type A person, and I never missed a deadline, much less, a deadline that I was under a lucrative contract to meet. So that was another signal. But almost worse was that I couldn't get that book to work. It wasn't like, oh, I need a little bit more time. I don't quite have the ending. I could not get that book to work. The writing was not shining. It didn't have that kind of brilliant life that I'm always looking for. It didn't have the honesty and truth that means a lot to me. I have always been able to rely on my own writing as a place to get rest and creative renewal and inspiration. I've always felt confident about it. And that breakdown, the breakdown of what I felt was like my career, was a major turning point, unfortunately, a turning point into more darkness and unraveling.
I wonder how much of that was also bound up with the pressure that society places on us to sustain success, to be something, to sort of measure up constantly. And once you have a successful book, I can only imagine that that pressure increases.
100%. And to me, this is the great crisis of our age, especially for creative people, and definitely for women. Because for women, you start to have success somewhere. For me, it was in publishing. Well, often for a man, that might be the moment where someone steps in and gives you an assistant or a raise. But for women, it's just one more burden put on our backs that we're just supposed to bear. That this time of my unraveling, my child was 2 years old. I was about to become pregnant again. I was still touring for my first book. I was working in marketing and branding. I was the only breadwinner in my family. And at no point, did anyone in my circle suggest, hey, why don't you take a little bit of weight off and let us help you? That never happened. And that's something that I still feel pretty angry about, to be honest. And I do a lot of one-on-one coaching with writers, not just writers who want to publish, but a lot of people who have already published, and they just can't believe the pressures to always be online, to always be closing, selling themselves, promoting their own books, not just Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, but now Instagram Live and TikTok. And I usually do it. I'm okay with being busy if I'm healthy, but when the health starts to go, whether it's physical or emotional, we just have to be more sensitive. I mean, I could go on about this forever, but it is one of the underlying reasons why I wrote Touch, was sort of my anger at the way that the digital age has forced us to have to clone ourselves. And I think that's the thing that so excites me about the topic I wrote about in my memoir, The Year of the Horses, is that for me and anyone who's truly savvy about horsemanship, when you are around these giant, potentially dangerous animals, you must stay focused. Forget about being on your phone. You can't even let your mind wander. They sense it, and you're going to end up in trouble. And it doesn't even matter if you're riding or not. I've seen instances where someone wasn't paying attention and they're on their phone and they get behind a horse and they're kicked, or at the very least pushed over by the incredibly powerful hindquarters. So it remains, aside from my writing, I would say, the one sacred place available to me right now where I truly focus.
This is Aaron Hicklin. You're listening to Shelf Life. And my guest is the author, Courtney Maugham, whose memoir, The Year of the Horses, has just been published. So we're back between your first and your second novel. You've been told you're close to a full-on adrenal failure. And somehow you find your way back from depression through horses. Can you tell me about that discovery or rediscovery, how that happened?
I mean, it hadn't been happening. I stopped writing when I was 9. I had a really fortunate upbringing. And when my parents divorced and circumstances changed, the writing fell away. And I really thought that part of my life was behind me. But, you know, there's a scene in the book where I'm at this birthday party for a 2-year-old. And for anyone listening, no one warns you about the birthday parties. These endless parties that not only do you need to bring your child to and stay there the whole time, and you have other things to do with your Saturday, but you also need to prep these presents and help the host or hostess cook and help them clean up. And in the scene, I'm really at kind of the bottom of the barrel, and I'm watching these kids strike a piñata. It's so violent. It seems akin to domestic violence. You know, if you hit something hard enough, candy comes out. I really hate piñata hitting. And so watching that was just making everything worse. And then at that moment, this father came in who I didn't know, very handsome man. And because we had never met, he came over to greet me and he said, "I'm sorry, I can't, you know, kiss you," or double air kiss, whatever. I just came from the barn. And I just grabbed this man by his hands and said, "You know, what barn? Where's your barn? Who's your trainer? Give me all the information." And I called the woman on the piece of paper that he gave me, scheduled a lesson, and that was it. Like, that was however many years ago, and there was no turning back. You know, I walked into this barn, and I hadn't been in a barn for so long, and it was just, the first thing was olfactory. It was the smell, you know, like, it was really like the smell of an old lover. This was used to be a huge part of my life. I used to smell that way because I was riding so much. And I just thought, my gosh, hello, it's nice to meet you. This is a part of myself that has been lost. And we found each other again. And of course, it didn't happen overnight. You know, it's still unfolding. But in the interim, learning to be around horses and ride them correctly necessitated that I learned to breathe, which meant learn how to calm myself, learned how to shrink my anxiety. And those breathing techniques, which, you know, I had learned in yoga and other practices, but they didn't work because I don't think I cared enough, but I cared about horses and I wanted to not be a threatening presence to them and to not be this stressful person. So pretty soon, once I started up with the horses, I started to sleep, not always through the night, but sleep and heal and gain a little weight back. And
What is the particular bond between women and horses that has so often been celebrated in literature and film? You know, I'm obviously thinking of Black Beauty and, and National Velvet. I wonder if you could tell me what you think is at the root of that connection.
Okay, so something I think about a lot, because I ask myself this question quite a bit, is horses' physicality. They are always in their bodies in a way that us humans are not, especially now when we work so much online and we work through our avatars. Many people know us but have never met us. They only know us through our Twitter feeds, right? We're a little bit disembodied. But horses, they are in their bodies and they're physical. And when they're excited, they rear and they kick. And when they gallop, I mean, you know, it's an absolute thing of beauty to watch a horse gallop. And I think that, in addition to offering us kind of boosted physicality, for me, at least, horses, they're an invitation to re-inhabit my own body in a way that culture doesn't really always invite me to do. You know, it's getting better now, right? But, you know, okay, you're a woman. Don't be angry. Just sort of take it and work hard and show them, you know, success is the best revenge. Or don't get too messy. Don't get too dirty. Don't sweat too much. Don't be too frenetic. Don't be too excited. Don't be too passionate. Don't be too sexual. You know, and horses, especially the mares, when they're in season, when they're in heat, you know, they raise their tails, right? And they tell all the males, "Hey, I'm ready to go." You know, they're very sensual beings. So I don't know. I don't know if that's it exactly, but even from afar, this invitation to kind of celebrate and contemplate our own physicality is there. And then when you combine it with the fact that if you choose to, you can ride a horse, thus combining these two physical beings, certainly it does make you feel that even for a short time, you have access to a power that sort of lies within you, but is catalyzed by the synergy with this huge beast who also somehow manages, you know, to be submissive.
Now, you've written that after your second novel, Touch, was published, you felt very strongly, and I'm assuming this was related to the depression you had been in or were still in, you felt very strongly that you needed to get back to private art making, is the expression you used. And I'm very inspired by that idea that it doesn't have to be for something greater than yourself. And I wonder what it meant for you to find that path to something that was private.
Yeah, you know, for me at that moment in my life, what that meant was to try to write something without telling anyone about it, you know, because I'd been very fortunate that my first book did well enough that my editor, whom I really adore, you know, they said, God, we really would love something else from Courtney. And, you know, I sold my second book on a partial, just a couple of chapters, a glimmer of an idea. I got a lot of money for it. And that was a path back then that was available to me, you know, to keep kind of pitching book ideas in a certain vein and to get livable advances off of them. A really, really fortunate place to be, I should add. But for me, the act of writing and making art with a deadline hanging over me and some expectations and people who had a financial investment in what I was writing, and, you know, even though they were so supportive, I had a hard time with that. As the person in charge of coming up with the content, I was not able to deliver any magic. I mean, I finally got it done. I love the iteration that finally published, but I just thought, oh my gosh, I need to go dark. My agent said, okay, what do you have next? What can we throw their way? And I said, I need to be left alone. You give me at least 6 months. I just need to find my own thing, not think about marketing and expectations, just be allowed to experiment. And sure enough, that's how Costa Alegre was born. And, you know, that was a book. When I showed it to my agent, she just said, I don't know what to do with this. This is a major pivot. It could be detrimental to your career. And it did represent a pivot. That book went with an independent press, which is the same press and the same editorial team publishing The Year of the Horses today. So, you know, it was open, fantastic relationships for me, but it was financially a different lane.
Mm. You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is the author Courtney Maugham, most recently of the memoir The Year of the Horses. Courtney, you were talking there about Costa Alegre, your third novel from 2019. I noticed with some amusement that you rated it 5 stars on the book nerd site Goodreads, along with the 5-word review, best book I've ever read. I loved your chutzpah. Is Costa Alegre the best book you've ever written?
No, I'm sure I've written that for each of my books on Goodreads. The algorithm is king, so you got to get it in there. And, you know, just like politicians vote for themselves, we got to do it too. So I love Costa Alegre, but I mean, I love all my book children. Costa Alegre does hold a special place in my heart because after many, many years of writing books that took incredibly heavy duty revision and lots of editorial board discussion about content, that book, I researched it for a full year, but when I sat down to write that, it came out like a fever dream, like in a month. I wrote it in a month. And the published version is very close to that first draft. That's a rare thing for me with fiction, incredibly rare. It really felt like a gift, so much so at this point now, I've been very fortunate to have met some of the Guggenheims and established some friendships with some of them. And some members of the family said that they thought that maybe Pagin Guggenheim was talking to me from the dead, you know, because I'd written stuff that no one else knew, you know.
Pagin Guggenheim, of course, is the daughter of Peggy Guggenheim. And in the foreground of Costa Alegre is Peggy Guggenheim's efforts to save the art and artists she was most interested in from the kind of depredations of the Nazis at the beginning of the Second World War or shortly before the Second World War. I wonder what was the particular challenge of taking a real life person like Peggy Guggenheim as the basis for fiction?
Well, especially with Peggy Guggenheim, the real challenge was to not lose 10 years of my life to research, because she is so interesting and complicated. I mean, her father went down on the Titanic. You know, just starting with a legacy like that is interesting enough. But then when you look at the artists whose lives, you know, she decided to save, partly for her own gain, right? Because she was collecting them. But still, when you start looking at the people who were at her proverbial dinner table, it did reach a point in my research where I thought I could spend the rest of my life simply researching the people in Peggy Guggenheim's Rolodex, and I will never get this book written. So really the challenge for me was saying, you have enough. It is fiction after all. It's a fictionalized account, and I changed all the names. Just start writing the darn book.
There's a lot of teenage girls yearning and longing in here. Did that reflect yourself at the age of 15?
I guess my primary source of research was my own diaries from age 14 and 15, because one thing I was struggling with, the book is written as a diary by Pegeen at the outbreak of World War II, when she's already been relocated with all of her mom's artists to this kind of crumbling hacienda in Mexico. And so I was thinking, okay, well, I don't want to get dragged for not putting enough of World War II in this, but she's 15, you know, and really, as all teenagers are, self-centered, obsessed with becoming an artist and really angry at her mom. She's much angrier at her mom than she is at Hitler. And I would go back to my diaries to prove to myself that that was an okay stance to take. And I remember one entry in particular, I think the Iraq war, one of the conflicts in Iraq had just broken out. And I made, you know, great pains to write at the top of my entry, like, I feel so terrible for our hardworking, valiant countrymen in Iraq. And then right under that was Rebecca's being a B-I-T-C-H. And I think that she's trying to steal Brian Shepherd away from me. And the rest was all about boys. You know, I didn't give a hoot. It didn't affect my life. And it would affect Begin's life later, but it was too early, you know. So it really gave me a lot of confidence to look at my own diaries. And of course, by that point, I was lucky enough to have a daughter myself, who, you know, you break some bad news to her, and unless it directly concerns her, for example, Gabriella, you cannot have dessert tonight, that's major. But if I say, honey, there's a war in Ukraine, and what that means is there won't be any more Snicker bars, right? It's the Snicker bars, not the war in Ukraine. So that helped a lot, you know, just giving myself permission to realize that, in fact, teenagers, they just haven't changed that much.
A small glimpse there into Courtney Morm's home life, Snicker bars and all. During your research, you discovered that Pegeen Guggenheim struggled with depression and actually ended up taking her own life. As someone who had been dealing with depression yourself, what kind of empathy did that create?
Gosh, what an interesting question. That's so interesting that you asked that. I've never thought about it. I think at the point I was writing that book, my discovering Pegeen and just almost felt like I was trying to rescue her and give her new life was also giving me life and hope. You know, aside from the horses, writing that book was such a delight, an absolute pleasure. So I just didn't allow negative feelings in. And in fact, when I was looking at Pegeen's life and just the facts of her life, what I remember being very moved by was the fact that she was separated from her brother more or less around the outbreak of the war and lived in different homes from him for the rest of their respective lives. And that's what happened to me and my brother, Brendan, actually. In Pegeen's case, it was more that her mom didn't want to deal with two kids. It was just a pain in the butt. And so her brother went to live with her dad. But in my case, my brother had such terrible health issues and developmental disabilities that my mom couldn't deal with both of us. So she kept my brother and I went to live with my dad. And that was something I dwelled on a lot, the kind of forced separation of siblings and what that would mean for someone, especially like Pegeen, who needed more attention and guidance than I did, because I was pretty self-sufficient. But that was a point of compassion and empathy that that I really had for her. And she struggled, encouraged by her mother. She was sort of bequeathed disordered eating. And that was something I struggled with quite a bit in my youth. I really feel like I went to college with her.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today, Courtney Maugham. We're talking about Rebecca Dynasty Knight's book, Hex. Courtney, I read some advice from Rebecca Dynasty Knight, whose book Hex we're about to talk about. She said the best writing advice she had was to make it a daily ritual. Bind writing to a daily non-writing activity so that you have a cue. The coffee, the computer, the toothbrush, 10 pets to the cat. She says, take the pressure off yourself to initiate writing and build it into an external sequence so you don't have to ask whether or when to begin. It's decided in advance. The dishes, the ginger snap, the computer. As someone who's written a guide to publishing and writing, I wonder if that advice from Rebecca Dynasty Knight there chimes with you and your experience.
100%. The people who usually manage not to succeed are the ones who decide, oh, I'll write when the feeling moves me. You know, that might be where we all start out when we're first starting to write. But if you actually want to make a life and a living in creative writing before it becomes a job, and maybe you earn a tiny bit of money, you have to treat it as such. I mean, I never wake up wondering, what will I do today? You know, unless, I mean, certainly not Monday through Friday, right? I know what I'm doing. And these rituals that she speaks of are very precious to each individual writer. I know my friend Matt Bell somehow manages to get up and run 8 miles every day at like 3 or 4 in the morning before he starts his writing day. My understanding is that Murakami swims some obscene amount of laps. You know, my mother, on a recent book event, my mom had to come to watch my daughter and didn't tell me until I was home that she'd shattered a mug of mine. She thought it was just some random mug. Well, let me tell you, you know where this is going. She did say, when I broke it, your daughter locked herself in her room. It was just wailing. And I said, well, that's because she knows that's my writing mug. I've written 3 books with that and you just broke it.
I think I need some detail here on the sadly departed mug. What was so special about it?
Okay. Well, Aaron, first of all, it was the perfect size with the perfect opening. Like, I'm a very specific tea drinker. I'm not the person that makes a big pod and savors it throughout the day. I allow myself, it has to be a very specific portion because of my insomnia. I drink Yorkshire blend tea. I want nothing but Yorkshire blend tea. And so first of all, this mug had the right heft. It had the right depth. But it was also, it was a mug that we'd bought in Poland from the Carlo Viveri Film Festival, where my husband, the film I worked on with him, had won the whole damn thing. But it is no longer with us, but I'm happy to say that I went to the Goodwill, which is my happy place, the Super Goodwill in Torrington, Connecticut, and I was able to find a very ugly mug that says, good morning, handsome. And it's just the right size. I'm becoming sentimentally attached to it, but if it was broken today, I would manage to go on.
Courtney, we have to talk about Hex. It's by Rebecca Dynasty Knight. It might very loosely be called a campus novel, but it's not like any campus novel I've read. The narrator is this fabulous character, Nell Barber, an expelled PhD candidate in biological science with an obsession with poisonous plants and how to use them and also how to neutralize them. Her love obsession is her mentor, Dr. Joan Callis. But Joan is one of a series of male and female characters that interact and spin around this short, tightly written novel. It's funny, poignant, completely original. I'd not heard of it. And I have to say, I don't think I've quite encountered a voice like Nell's ever. I started this book slightly hesitant, I have to say, because it was sort of like going to a country I'd not visited before. I was trying to figure my way out. And then very quickly, I was just writing things down. I mean, she has such wonderful turns of phrase, but perhaps we should start with a short reading from the book just to set the scene. I wonder if you have something for us.
I do. I hope that I do Rebecca justice, but I'm going to read very shortly into the book. They're organized in quite short vignettes or chapters. And this one is called Kansas. When you grow up in Kansas wearing very large shorts, thinking not very much of yourself, thinking mainly of your knees, looking mainly at your knees, your face a frisbee that can't fly, your teeth buck, your eyebrows rectangles, your forehead more than half your face, your shirts shapeless, your shape shapeless, your Kansas shapeless, your lust absent, your legs bowed, your arches flat, your chest flat, your ears your only curves, your ears never pierced, your denim never dazzled, your sneakers white, your socks white, your teeth turquoise with rubber bands, your cheese orange, your milk whole, your bread wonder, your luxury a tuna casserole, your pale a neon pale, your fantasy to race a Mario Kart over the desert and into the final oasis, your earthly oasis a salted pretzel, your solitude total, your urges not even visible to you on the clearest days at the farthest horizons, your blank magnificent, your inertia wild and authentic, your nothing your preference, and then into it somebody walks, a Joan. This sudden hero can really take control. You're susceptible first to idolatry, and then to study, to apprenticeship, finally to a kind of patient love that makes fun of itself and believes in itself without limit. Imagine being a pudding cup of a person and encountering a confident, elegant, powerful scholar who knows what to do with her shoulders. Imagine encountering you. I think I can stop there, because if you don't like that, well, how sad for you.
Something's wrong with you. Just that face, like a frisbee that cannot fly, a description that Nell Barber applies to herself, gives you a flavor of the unusual, often startling images you come across in this book. I've written down a bunch. One that struck me was dining out with Tom, one of the characters. Nell observes 10 cold sesame noodles dangling from my lips like a car wash.
Yeah, it's. I was reading some of the reviews of this book while preparing for our talk, and I was very sad to see that some reviewers thought there were too many images and too many metaphors, and I wanted to stand up and scream and defend Rebecca, because she's a poet first. You know, she cut her teeth on poetry, and I personally just adore reading prose by poets because it's so weird and so fresh. And, you know, the comparison to a car wash, I think, plants this so firmly in the domestic realm, which is what Nell is yearning for with Dr. Joan, right? She would probably love nothing more than to go through a car wash with her mentor. But, you know, her mentor doesn't want that. Instead, she's across from her ex-boyfriend, who's this unicorn-obsessed medieval and Renaissance scholar. So the whole thing is very funny to me. I love that you call it a campus novel. I hadn't thought of it that way, but it's like a campus novel by an expelled PhD student.
You learn an awful lot in here about poisonous botanicals. Lots of poets who reference some of these botanicals in their poetry, and also famous poisoning cases. I think there's one of a Romanian who was jabbed with a poison-tipped umbrella by an assailant on Waterloo Bridge in London in the late 70s.
That's so polite.
I've always been obsessed with that case. I think that was ricin that was used, which happens to come, as I now know, thanks to Rebecca Dynasty Knight, from the seeds of the castor oil plant. Did you learn things from this book?
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean... I am a terrible botanist. First of all, I can't keep anything alive. And it just so happens that my beloved mother-in-law, my French mother-in-law, is a fantastic botanist and someone with a real green thumb, and is constantly sending me gorgeous cards that have the Latin names of flowers. You know, she's always asking me specific questions about the trees in our yards and the leaves, and I have nothing to offer, which became even worse when I had a child who has questions about the natural world, and I am unable to answer any of them. So I learned everything, really, because I started from zero.
You're listening to Shelf Life. My guest today is the author, Courtney Maugham. We've been talking about Hex by Rebecca Dynasty Knight. We'll be back after this.
There's no time so sweet as when true lovers meet by the bright silvery light of the moon. Next time on the Wuggle of the Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, we'll hear a lament to the moon. We'll be blowing out the moon, and the moon will be shining bright. Join me for moon songs on the Wuggle of the Monkeys here on Radio Catskill on Sunday afternoon at 3.
Radio Catskill, keeping Pennsylvania voters connected this election season. October 20th is the last day to register to vote in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania voters can apply for a mail-in ballot for any reason. The last day to apply for a civilian absentee or mail-in ballot is October 28th. County boards of elections must receive mail-in ballots by 8 p.m. on November 4th. Election Day is also November 4th. Pennsylvania polls are open on Election Day from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. This is Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is the author Courtney Maugham. We're talking about Hex by Rebecca Dinnerstein Knight. Courtney, what do you think makes this book work for you?
Probably the weirdness. I mean, it is very, very hard for me to get into a book that has no humor, but the humor I most appreciate is usually absurdist, sometimes situational comedy, but I love surrealism and absurdity. And some of the situations that this woman, Nell, is in, you know, the the reason she's expelled is because one of her fellow cohorts, they were all studying these poisonous plants and he ended up dying, you know, from the very plants they were studying. So they shut down the department. And I don't know, it's like the intense meaning and meaninglessness of academia, you know, it's like deeply moving to me, you know, these niches within which people are dedicating all of their lives and time and resources, these tiny, tiny things. But yeah, to me, it's the oddball humor. It's the wild reflections and metaphors and images that she comes up with that are totally fresh. And I think it's just a great book for people who are in a little bit of a rut and have not, they feel like they're reading the same thing all the time or nothing's really grabbing them and provoking them. This is a perfect book for that. You won't see a comparison of noodle eating to, you know, car wash sitting in anyone else's book.
She's very good at conjuring what people look like and how they carry their body and hold themselves. I found it in that sense quite a sensual book. I could imagine these men's bodies, but also, of course, Joan's personality, this sort of love icon at the center of the novel. Were any of these people reminiscent for you of students you were at college with?
Maybe one person, the boyfriend character, the medieval Renaissance student, not someone I was with college with, but a teenager on my polo arena team that I write about in the book. This was someone obsessed with underwater shipwrecks and also calorie absorption through astronaut food. Often it was hard for him to concentrate on what we were supposed to be doing in the arena on our horses because he had all of this knowledge to share about the shipwrecks and the astronaut food. But mostly I just really admire that, you know, it is called Hex because of some witchy spells, but it's also hexagon because of the number of people in a, well, it's not a love triangle, right? It's a love hexagon. And I just like that these people were so nerdy and specific and imperfect and not necessarily people you would lust for, but then they do kind of end up coming in and out of each other's lives in sexual ways. And that was great to read because normally when you get to read sex in literary fiction, which is incredibly rare because editors get nervous when it's there because it pushes it into the realm of romance, which for whatever reason people think is lesser, right? I don't, but some people do. I don't know, you usually see it from coming, you know, 20 miles off. There's the bodice ripper and then there's the person with the bodice. And this, you know, you don't necessarily see coming, you know.
The plot is pretty simple, but the writing shimmers. As we mentioned, Rebecca Dinnerstein Knight really goes for sort of some startling word choices. But she used a phrase that you have also used about Costa Alegre. She said she wrote this as a kind of fever dream in a matter of, for her, a matter of 6 months. That sounds like a very graceful state to be in as a writer and probably a rare one.
Yeah, I mean, not everyone will be able to relate to this, but to me, it did feel a little bit like carrying a baby to term, you know, that like the intensity of labor where you just have to get this thing out. That's what it felt for me, at least when I was writing Costa Alegre. I mean, every night and day, I would just think, gosh, I love my family, my husband and my daughter. Can they just get the hell out of here? I need to get my daughter on the bus because I know exactly what my work is. I have to get this book out. You know, it was just this, there were no questions. It just kind of came out fully formed. But again, for me, that's something I was able to sit down and do after a year of research and also cutting myself off from doing further research. I have to imagine, I don't know this for sure, but the information about botany here is so specific. I mean, I think she did work or intern on farms or something, so she must have already had quite a lot of information. But I wonder if she was able to accomplish both the writing and the research in 6 months. That would be astonishing.
Right, right. It's also a novel that reminded me that that sort of process of discovering that other people have grown up very differently to you and have had different experiences and upbringings. She has a friend called Mishti, who's a great character in her own right. And there's a moment when Mishti is talking about the men in her life and she has different kinds of ways of describing them. And the narrator says, I realized that Mishti had been dating since she was 13 years old and that she was symmetrical and had understood more about her own body and sexuality at the age of 7 than I did today. And I love that line because it just took me to that place where you, especially when you're sort of young and, you know, late teens perhaps, and you realize that some people have so much more knowledge about fundamental things like sex than you do.
I mean, you know, this is how most people feel all the time now, because to be alive in the world right now, it really feels like it's about putting a stake in the ground about what your expertise is. So often, you know, you're confronted with people who are going to start talking to you about NFTs or gosh knows what, right? And they know more about it than you do. Sometimes that can be inspiring. You know, I mean, I think it's neat when you have a conversation with someone and realize, my goodness, they have this incredibly specific and hard-earned insight on a topic that never interested me before, you know, or that makes me see myself and my own life in a new way. I mean, I think that that's one of the ultimate acts of generosity, that is reading a book, you know.
Hello, if you've just joined us, this is Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. My guest today is the author Courtney Maugham, and we're talking about Wolf in White Van, by the musician John Daniel. Courtney, it's time to talk about your second book choice today, which is Wolf in White Van by John Daniel, which was published in 2014. John Daniel is best known, of course, as the lead singer of the Mountain Goats. This is a book about a loner, Sean Phillips, who was never popular and is even less so after losing his face, quite literally, and is now more or less housebound. Left to his own devices, he creates a choose-your-own-adventure game called Trace Italian, which is played by mail and becomes a success, though it seems no one can win and no one can lose. You just keep on playing. Courtney, I can no longer remember how much of a sad, misunderstood teenager I felt, but I definitely played a mail-based adventure game. It was called It's a Crime. This was the 1980s, so it was a long time ago. The object of which was to graduate from street punk to Godfather, if I remember correctly. It was played in the streets of New York, and I grew up in a small English village, so it was very exciting. Were you a game enthusiast as a kid?
So Legend of Zelda and Oregon Trail. Yes, I wasn't so big on Mario Kart, but I was absolutely obsessed with Zelda and the Oregon Trail. If I ever got a tattoo, it would probably be of the wagon and, you know, some dead person that just got syphilis and a dead bull beside it. But what I really was and continue to be, and that's what moved me very much about this book, was I was a pen pal. You know, fan. And I still am. One of my dearest, bestest friends is someone that I was pen pals with when I was 9 years old. We'd met at camp. We weren't even that close, but I kind of forced her into this letter writing. She's actually godmother to my daughter. So the idea of a game designed by a shut-in that's played by letter writing, even as the internet, you know, is blooming. I find it incredibly touching.
I wonder what was in those letters you sent to your pen pal as a 9-year-old.
It's all about boys and how much I hate my family.
Trace Italian is the name of this mail order game at the heart of the novel, but it's also something of a metaphor for life and the kind of random choices we make. I wonder what you found in it to relate to.
I've never played Dungeons and Dragons. I loved the Choose Your Own Adventure series. So the analog world of advancing through storytelling, you know, or choices in storytelling is something that I can relate to. But mostly, yeah, again, it's just the idea of these letters sort of being slipped under the door of this poor young man who's disfigured and kind of hiding away in his parents' house. Certainly in America, the trope of the young white boy in a basement is a really dark and hopeless thing. It's sort of where the incel movement is born. And you think of these people on Reddit plotting mass shootings and things. And in fact, he's spreading joy and hope through this weird, incredibly slow-moving game. And it's just throwing water in the fire of the internet that's starting to engulf everything. For me, when I was little, my obsession was books. So that's close enough that I feel like I can relate to Sean and how much satisfaction and kinship he finds through this gaming community, the Trace Italian that he's created.
It's somewhat of a novel that works back to front in that we don't really know why he's disfigured in the face until we get closer to the end. Did that work for you?
I read this, I think, right when it came out. So I hadn't read any reviews. I hadn't had any spoilers. So I was blown away. I thought it was incredible. And also, you know, hallmark of a very mature writer and probably a great editor, because a lot of editorial teams would force you to put that kind of reveal up front.
Mm-hmm. The title Wolf in White Van comes from the supposed subliminal messages hidden in rock and heavy metal songs, and that you can apparently hear when you play a vinyl record backwards. I certainly remember with my heavy metal loving friends as a kid trying to do this with Iron Maiden and Metallica records. Did you have any satanic experiences as a child with records or otherwise?
Well, I mean, I definitely looked for them, right? Like, I was not a huge heavy metal fan, but I did love me some Metallica and Pink Floyd. Not that they're heavy metal, but still, there were certain albums that I was listening to that we did try to play them backward. But mostly, I was and sort of still remain like a deep believer in fantasy, heavily obsessed with mermaids and unicorns, and was convinced that they existed. So again, the access to kind of those magical wonderlands makes sense to me. It makes sense to me that I like this book. I had something written down here. I think it's from the New York Times Review, where Dwight Garner wrote, "The book exemplifies just how starved everybody is for some magic pathway back into childhood." And I certainly related to that reading this book as an adult, thinking, oh my gosh, even having the time and stillness to just settle down and write a letter. It's kind of amazing, the idea of writing to a stranger and then having to wait weeks for the response that would tell you what your next move is in the game.
Yes.
I mean, can you imagine that level of patience these days? I can barely, in a 4 hours goes without getting a response to one of my emails. I get hives. So I think that the patience involved in this game, where there's the patience that you need to play it, and then there's the patience as the main character's massive injury heals, and also emotionally he's trying to heal from the thing that disfigured him. It's really tender. I mean, it's very dark. Darnell's work is sometimes very difficult. You know, you really do worry about some of the characters in his book. They're always young adolescents, male adolescents, and they're always on the brink of doing something very, very, very dumb that will completely ruin the rest of their lives.
Courtney, I know you spent a lot of your adult life as a copywriter. You said it. Mm-hmm. You've said that it taught you not to be precious in your own writing. I wonder, what was the most inane copyright assignment?
Oof. Okay, well, I worked for half a year with the Victoria's Secret catalog. So, you know, while I'm grateful for what that taught me about deadlines, I'm not very high-end products were being written about. I've done quite a lot of copywriting for hernia reparation products.
Courtney, if you were to write some copy to pitch these two novels that you've chosen today, how would you sell Wolf in White Van versus Hex?
Oh, gosh. Everyone listening is going to be like, she stinks as a copywriter. Okay, Wolf in White Van. You think you're lonely? You're not as lonely as this guy. Hex, unrequited love has never burned this good.
I want to see those on the strap lines of the books, or at least on the publisher's site.
Yeah, and I think I would combine the two of them. Unrequited love, it'll burn your face off.
You have written about love. At least you've written about divorce and infidelity. Mm-hmm. Your first novel, I'm Having So Much Fun Here Without You, which must win an award for one of the best titles. You chose to write it from the male point of view, through the character of Richard Haddon, a British artist. Why was that, I wonder?
Honestly, it never occurred to me to do it any other way. I don't know. Most of my friends were men at that point. I was working in an all-male industry. I was in alcohol distribution in Paris, France. But in hindsight, I know now, because this is something I do all the time, I prefer really to write from a male point of view. It's easier for me because the minute I am a man in my head, then I don't have any parents and I don't have children. I don't have a past. Everything is fresh and new and I have a blank slate. Whereas the minute I try to write from a woman's voice, I can't get myself out of the way. If there's a mom, it's my mom. I'm going to feel forced to give the woman a child. You know, I'm right away going to pivot toward careers in advertising that I've had. And I just can't get my own experience out of the way. So I've always preferred to either write from a male point of view or the point of view of an inanimate object or something like that, or a famous person, a celebrity. It just makes everything easier in terms of inventing worlds.
Courtney Morm, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me today. I've so enjoyed our conversation.
As have I. Thank you so much. And I can't wait to have some Yorkshire blend tea with you, Aaron.
Yes, I'll make sure it's on hand at the Deepwater Literary Fest on June 18th, just to remind listeners that Courtney Morm will be here and in person in Narrowsburg on June 18th. We've been talking about Hex by Rebecca Dinnerstein Knight, published by Penguin, and Wolf in White Van by John Darnielle, published by MCD. Courtney Morm's latest book, The Year of the Horses, has just been published by Tin House. More information on the titles we discussed in this episode, as well as others, can be found on grandjournal.net. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and 1 Gram Books. And if you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify, with guests such as Alan Cumming, John Waters, Joyce Maynard, and Kevin Barry. While you're there, consider giving us a review or a rating. It can really help.
Registration is now open for the Upper Delaware River Rendezvous, the annual conference bringing together the many partners working to improve the watershed. Happening October 15th and 16th, the 2025 Rendezvous is designed to promote collaborations among researchers, practitioners, community leaders, and other watershed stakeholders. With engaging sessions, keynote speakers, networking, and more. UDRWatershed.org/rendezvous. paid for by Friends of the Upper Delaware River.
Jake Sullivan served as national security advisor in the Biden White House. He says President Trump weakens U.S. leadership by not keeping his word in foreign affairs. So I asked Sullivan, hasn't that been the case with a lot of U.S. presidents?
Okay, I'll say two things about this. One, I did not expect the red line in Syria to come up tonight, of all things.